before. Build back better. We also made the most significant investment in science and innovation. America invented the semiconductor. Now we're bringing those chip factories back home to America where they belong. I've stood with you in Columbus, Syracuse, Phoenix, and many more fields of dreams where these fabs, these massive new factories the size of several football fields, are being built. And I speak, as I speak, you're going to create at least 125,000 good-paying jobs. And the jobs in these fabs are going to pay over $100,000 a year, and you don't need a college degree. You don't have to move from your hometown. You can stay where you are. If I could pause a minute, you know what's going to happen as well? When you build these factories, they're going to have to build more barbershops, beauty salons. I'm not joking. They're going to build grocery stores. They're going to build drug stores. It grows communities in a big way. We will soon be the only economy in the world to have all five of the top chip companies operating in America, creating thousands of jobs. And for the first time in decades, these new factories are producing the most advanced chips right here in America. These aren't just fabs, these investments are creating opportunities for entire communities, for small business, creating even more jobs, and so much more. I've kept my commitment to be president for all of America, whether you voted for me or not. In fact, studies show my programs have delivered more for red states than blue states. The results are clear. 16.6 million new jobs, the lowest average unemployment rate for 50 years, a record 21 million new applications to start new businesses. And every one of those applications is an act of hope in your communities. Wages are up, inflation is down, and we passed the most significant gun safety law in 30 years. We're slashing overdose deaths by 26% last year. You did it faster than ever, and seizing record amounts of fentanyl, making life-saving Narcan available over the counter. Violent crime is now at a 50-year low. Because of you. The bottom line, you've produced an incredible 4 years. So much we got done together. It'll take time to see and feel, though. But the seeds have been planted. Will grow and they'll bloom for decades to come, and none of it could have happened without all of you. And that's not hyperbole, none of it. You know, we're not finished yet. Earlier today, I announced three major priorities that mark important progress in our country. First, after fighting Big Pharma for decades as a senator and then vice president as president, we finally beat Big Pharma. Instead of paying $400 a month for insulin, seniors now pay $35 a month. But that wasn't the only thing that happened when we passed the bill. Starting this month, the total prescription drug cost for seniors is capped at $2,000, no matter how expensive their drugs are. Even expensive cancer drugs that cost $10,000, $12,000, $14,000, they're not going to have to pay more than $2,000 a year. And finally, we gave Medicare the power to negotiate lower drug prices like the VA has been able to do for veterans all along. These negotiations are being implemented in phases. The first phase negotiated lower prices for the 10 most expensive drugs for seniors, covering drugs for blood costs and so much more. And just this morning, I announced the next phase, the next 15 drugs subject to negotiations. Drugs that will treat cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and so much more, including Ozempic. Hard to say. But it really is an incredible drug. These reforms just don't save seniors money. They save the American taxpayer $160 billion. The taxpayer over the next decade. Why? That $160 billion in Medicare is saving for negotiating lower drug prices in Big Pharma doesn't have to be paid out by the government. $160 billion. Second, just over 100 years ago, a pioneering group of women proposed Equal Rights Amendment to enshrine the principles of gender equality in our Constitution. Throughout my career, I've been clear, no one should be discriminated against based on their sex. And in order for the amendment to be ratified, it requires 3/4 of the states to ratify it. That benchmark was passed when Virginia ratified the ERA a few years ago. Today, I affirm the Equal Rights Amendment to have cleared all the necessary hurdles to be added to the U.S. Constitution now. The Equal Rights Amendment is the law of the land now. It's the 28th Amendment to the Constitution now. I consulted dozens of constitutional scholars to make sure there was all within the power to do this. And the fact is, we did. And third, our cities are places for a second chance. Earlier today, I commuted the sentence of nearly 2,500 convicted nonviolent drug offenders. These individuals are serving a disproportionately long and harsh sentence compared to the sentence they would receive had they committed the crime today. After spending too long behind bars, these individuals will soon be reunited with their families and communities. With this action, I make no apology. I've issued more individual pardon and commutation than any president in U.S. history. There is more work to do, but when we allow our justice system to be placed, a place of both accountability and mercy, it strengthens our cities and our nation as well, in my view. Let me close with this. Serving as your president has been the honor of my life. When my term in office is ending, the work continues. Your work continues. My farewell address 2 days ago, I talked how each of us must be guardians of democracy to restore the strength of our institutions and democracy. The presidency, the Congress, the courts, all have minimum requirements under the law to deal with those safeguards, and a free and independent press, and yes, local governments. The strength of our institution depends on the character of leaders like you. In our time together, I'm forever thankful to have seen the strength, your strength and your character. And we need it now more than ever. The magic of America has been everyone has a fair shot. Everyone is determined to be able to be treated with dignity. No guarantee, just a fair shot. I've always believed America can be defined in one word. I remember being in the Tibetan Plateau with Xi Jinping. I met with him for over 90 hours alone. Traveled 17,000 miles with him. Very significant differences. He looked at me and he said, "Can you define America for me?" And I said in one word, possibilities. We're the only nation in the world. Only nation in the world. That's come out of every crisis we've ever gone in stronger than we went in. Only one. Look at the history. We're the only nation in the world that believes when we act together, there's not a damn thing we can't do. Only in America, we believe anything is possible. You just have to remember who we are. We're the United States of America. Nothing is beyond our capacity when we do it together and act together. God bless you all. Keep working together. We need you. We need you. We need you. We need you. And may God protect our troops. Thank you so very much.
And finally, something from our friends at Native Land Podcasting. Confirmation. We are a couple of days out from the shifting of administrations. And when a new president and vice president come in, yes, a whole new cabinet, a whole new staff, and all the other comes in with it. But of course, as y'all know, because we've talked about it on this podcast before, that this is a particularly special time with this Trump administration transition, because these folks are also going to be trying to deepen into the government infrastructure, the employment infrastructure, to make sure that they have loyal people at every level of the government. We ought to keep our eyes out for that. But right now, let's check out some of the heads of agencies and departments who are undergoing confirmation. We began the week with Keith Hegseth. Pete Hegseth, who is up for Secretary of the Department of Defense of these United States. And I'd love for you to take a quick look at how he was handled during one of those questioning periods here.
We have hundreds of women who are currently in the infantry, lethal members of our military serving in the infantry, but you degrade them. You say, we need moms, but not in the military, especially in combat units. You will be in charge of 3 million personnel. It is a big job. And when you make these public statements, and I get you were not Secretary of Defense then. I get you were on TV. I get you were helping veterans. I get it was a different job. But most recently, you said this in November of 2024, knowing full well you might have been named as Secretary of Defense. So please explain these types of statements, because they're brutal and they're mean and they disrespect men and women who are willing to die for this country.
I spent months talking to active duty service members, men and women, low ranks, high ranks, combat arms and not combat arms. And what each and every one of them told me, and which personal instances have shown me, is that in ways direct, indirect, overt, and subtle, standards have been changed inside infantry training units, ranger school, infantry battallions, to ensure that commanders meet...
Give me one example. Please give me an example. I get you're making these generalized statements.
Commanders meet quotas to have a certain number of female infantry officers or infantry enlisted, and that disparages those women.
Commanders do not have to meet quotas for the infantry. Commanders do not have to have a quota for women in the infantry. That does not exist. It does not exist.
Y'all, that's a brief preview of what yesterday looked like. So that was a New York State Senator.
New York Senator
representing, obviously, the state of New York, Kirsten Gillibrand, who I have to tell you, I felt like she and the women on that committee yesterday, Mazie Hirono, and many others, even former vice presidential nominee and senator from where, Virginia?
Tim Kaine.
I'm mad we don't playing that. Watch that.
Either way, all I want to say is I thought that, one, it was clear no Republican defected, and Hegseth is, you know, probably going to get the votes that he needs. But that was him being taken to task over his comments about women, moms not being in the military, so on and so forth, and them members of the Democratic Party holding him accountable to some of them. And it got fiery yesterday. If you didn't see that, I hope folks are able to check it out. Tiffany and Angela, I know y'all monitored it as well. What were your highlights from the hearing?
And I just want our listeners and viewers to know who is getting confirmed and for what this week. So this week on Tuesday, we just talked about Pete Hegseth, who faced the Senate and as Secretary of Defense. On Wednesday, Pam Bondi out of Florida is in confirmation hearings for Attorney General, as is Senator Marco Rubio for Secretary of State. As is former Congressman Sean Duffy of Wisconsin.
He will of the real world.
Real world fame. He will be in confirmation hearings for Secretary of Transportation. John Ratcliffe for CIA Director. This is a big deal because, as you know, Chris Wray, the outgoing, Chris Wray is FBI.
Yeah, FBI.
The CIA Director is very important because if you watch Lioness, there are a lot of issues facing facing our country. Chris Wright, Secretary of Energy, he's an executive of a natural gas company based in Denver. Russell Vaught, Director of Office, OMB, Office of Management and Budget, which is a big deal. Scott Turner on Thursday, which is HUD. He is a former football player who served as a mid-level official in the first Trump administration. He's been elevated to lead a cabinet position. Lee Zeldin for the EPA, Environmental Protection AG. Doug Burgum, another Trump loyalist, for Interior Secretary. Scott Bessent, Treasury. You can imagine that is a huge deal, a huge deal. Bessent. And Kristi Noem, who infamously wrote about shooting her dog, her puppy. She will be facing the Senate on Friday for Homeland Security. So things are moving quickly on Capitol Hill. We obviously, by the time some of you all may listen to this, we have already, we have not talked about it because it wasn't happening at the time that we had this discussion. But pay keen attention to what's happening on Capitol Hill, because these are the people who will be leading government. Angela, have you, because the House doesn't really deal with confirmation hearings, what has traditionally been the role, I think a lot of people wonder this, of the Congressional Black Caucus, who serves in the lower chamber of the House? What has traditionally been their role with helping confirm people or trying to stop people from confirmation since they're not on the Senate side?
Yeah, so I'll take on the latter because that's the day and age we are in now. I think that their role really is to help people understand folks' records. They'll go on air. They'll talk to their colleagues in their state delegation. They will meet with people that they have friendly relationships with, such as if they share views of the Progressive Caucus or if they're in the Blue Dogs or whatever. They will meet and talk about things that they know about these individuals. Some of them have worked with these nominees. We know Pam Bondi and her role with some really tragic events in Florida. Some of the Florida delegation is certain to speak out against some of those things that she's done, including some of the ways in which she's been responsible for some massive injustice, including saying that Donald Trump actually won Pennsylvania in 2020. So you can expect to hear the Pennsylvania delegation speak out against that. They will write letters to senators and, again, talk to their friends. But there's not a formal role. They don't have any voting procedures, any hearings that they conduct on those actual nominations themselves.
And it doesn't sound like anybody can stop it. I mean, you don't. Yeah. You have Senator Joni Ernst, who is herself a survivor of abuse and sexual assault, who is willing to vote for Pete Hegseth as Secretary of Defense, who will be in charge of 3 million people and a massive budget, who has never managed more than 80 people. And he's also been accused of sexual assault, and she is voting for him. Andrew, I don't know what it will take. Like, this is not a Senate. It is a cult. These are people who are there. Every question they ask, it is on some level, are you a Trump loyalist? You know, Democrats keep asking, will you say no? And that was one of the questions. We should play this clip of Pam Bondi, because you and I disagree on how she handles this question. So let's hear from Pam Bondi, who is in confirmation hearings to become the next attorney general. Let's take a listen.
Would you have hired someone into the Florida Attorney General's office who you knew had an enemies list?
Senator, to cut to the chase, you're clearly talking about Kash Patel. I don't believe he has an enemies list.
Kash Patel has a published enemies list.
Yes.
So she has perjured herself as the next attorney general, lying to Congress when she knows full damn well that Kash Patel has an enemies list. Not only does he have his enemies list, it is published. We gonna put it up on the screen right now. Run that thing back. What does that say, Pam? You know better, Pam. Stop lying, Pam. That's all I gotta say about that.
I just want to tell the viewers, Kash Patel is who Trump has tapped to run the FBI. And he has called members of the FBI, people, employees of the FBI, the deep state. He is a person. These are all people who are out. Pam Bondi herself has said, we're going to prosecute the prosecutors. We're going to investigate the investigators. They are all trafficking on an enemies list. I am curious, from a legal perspective, can she plead ignorance? Can she say, well, I didn't know he had this published enemies list? And what's important to know about this is Kash Patel will be reporting into the DLJ. Pam Bondi will essentially be one of his bosses. They all serve at the pleasure of the president, but the FBI falls under the DLJ. Andrew,
I also think she said,
guys,
I don't believe
okay,
that he has.
Well, that's her legal loophole.
And quite frankly, the reason why I said she had done well or was doing well is because she was able to back out of basically everything she said leading up to this.
Has she done well, or are their questionings crappy?
Well, we've seen them be very crafty.
Really?
She has been answering well. She is giving Democrats and certainly the Republicans the cover they need by saying, I will be the who's your client as the Attorney General?
Yes, I do.
The Constitution and the American people are my client, right? So they're trying to say, you're going to work for Donald Trump. She says, no, the Constitution and the American people are my client. I may be asked to advise him. And then in other areas, it was, did Joe Biden win the presidency? Joe Biden is the president, the 46th president, and Donald Trump will be the 47th president. So just these obfuscations
that... I don't think that was a good answer.
It wasn't a good answer.
I don't think she handled it well. She refused. What I took away from that, she refused to say that Joe Biden got a majority of the votes.
She agreed.
She is still an apology. She
how do we define good? Like, are we saying good? No, we don't like it?
I think it shifted so much.
But here's my question. How are we defining, is it a good answer? Are we saying good by the standards of integrity and what is moral and what is right? Or are we saying good and that it was effective?
Effective. And effective to this end.
Yeah.
Effective to the end that it causes no Republican senators to then jump on a line of questioning that creates what looks like an opening on the right for her to be defeated. And so far, just as in Hegseth's confirmation, not one single Republican senator chased down a line of questioning that would have in any way held him accountable. None whatsoever. Ernst was going to be the one who probably got closest to opening the door. Mm-hmm. Didn't even open it. Closed it. You know, right shut. So what I mean by good is no, I think the answer is disingenuous. I think there's some credibility issues there. And, you know, I wish there was a way to hold it a greater account. But to the point of effectiveness is, will it cause any Republicans consternation? And right now, as the American people
were
to hear that.
Their consternation bar is very...
No, not mine, but theirs.
No, I said theirs. I didn't say yours. So, yeah, like, I don't know, like, they would, she would have to go in there and, like, light herself on fire and roll around for them to have any consternation.
I mean, in truth, her predecessor nominee for that office gave them consternation, and he dropped out, right? He had to withdraw, and of course, I'm talking about Matt Gaetz. Mm-hmm. Had to withdraw from that position. So there are some people.
Well, that's because there was a report coming out about his alleged.
But the report was always coming out, and we always knew that the man was truly guilty.
They thought that they were going to be able to hold it up. Remember, they thought that they were going to.
I personally did not believe that they would have success at keeping from 100 U.S. senators.
Better faith in them.
Detail, but I don't think that detail mattered to them at all.
Right. I don't think that mattered to them. Nothing. What does matter to them? I mean, the only thing that matters on the Republican side of the divide is how loyal will you be to Donald Trump?
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it.
I agree.
Yeah. Even at risk of national security, how loyal will you be to Donald Trump? Pam Bondi was also, she lobbied for the country of Qatar. I mean, there are so many of Pete Hegseth, like we didn't see a full FBI background check on him.
And they still didn't release it.
And they're not going to, the other thing is, we're talking about the FBI background checks. They're also not going to have to go through the traditional security clearance process. They didn't hire a firm to make it okay for all these folks to get security clearances, whether they've had issues with the law or not. Even the president will have top secret and classified information available to him as a convicted felon. That is unheard of. There's so many.
Can I ask you about that? Because you've gone through the security clearance process, and I'm struck by that. What is the process? Like, what are some things that they're looking for that you went through that these people might be able to bypass?
Yeah, they're looking for any issues with finances, like if you have significant debt, because if you have significant
debt,
I ain't never getting confirmed.
Shut up. I'm not talking about confirmation. I was talking about the security clearance
process. Okay,
but I will just say, like, they're looking for significant debt because they think that folks who have significant debt are more easily bribed. They are looking for whether or not you have any felony or any significant character issue. So that's why I'm saying it is amazing to me that even to get a freaking pre-check, to get TSA pre-check, there are certain things that you can't have. To get global entry, you cannot have had a DUI on your record. Mm. All of that stuff is out the window for Trump and his cabinet picks, and arguably some of the folks that he is hiring to work in the White House that don't have to be Senate confirmed. So the bar and the standard is significantly shifting. And I wonder what happens when the proletariat realizes that the bar has shifted for some, but not for all. What happens?
I'll just say this. The high point for me is, and I know we're going to break after this, is simply that, one, the foxes are in charge of the hen houses. In every department, every secretary, every appointee there is antithetical, by and large, to the mission and even in some cases, education, i.e., the existence of certain departments that they are now in charge of. And so what that leaves for the rest of us, one, no, there's not going to be a lot of shock and awe. It's going to be pretty awful, their efforts. But two, they still have to be held to account at every turn. We still have to make noise about it. We still have to make sure people are aware. And I think more importantly, our vigilance, our eternal vigilance, is really going to be needed on the stuff that they don't talk about out loud. The little bread trails they're not leaving behind. We know enough about Hegseth to know that the man don't like women. He don't like black people. He's questionable of people of color. And if he had it his way, it would be an all-white male-run U.S. military that basically bends to the whims of him and Donald Trump.
He will politicize the military.
It's already done. His answers yesterday were so political. I mean, this week we're incredulous.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite show.
The One World Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, diversity, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
One World Radio on WREQ Hempstead, 88.7 FM New York, and Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, 89.5 FM. My name is Ricky Hubert alongside Cody Millar, and we are joined by Dan Engvalson. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today on the program.
Thanks for having me, guys.
You're welcome, Dan. Now, to start off, tell us a little bit about why we want to bring you on the program today, your music, all kinds of stuff like that, what you do. Who is Dan?
Well, I guess that is the $64,000 question, and I think that's probably what we all ask ourselves when we wake up in the mornings. I am, I guess, first and foremost, two things, really, an artist and musician, performer, and slash a teacher. To me, it's very important to pass music on to not only the next generation, but also everybody who wants to learn. I have so many retired folks that really love to take lessons and just, you know, play very casually. You know, you have occasionally there's very enthusiastic students that, you know, really kind of practice on their own. And that's always fantastic to see. You don't see that quite as often these days, but it is awesome. And also another thing that I would like to get into in the future is kind of reaching out a little bit more toward the Guitars for Vets. There's a program called Guitars for Vets. And I would like to, you know, reach out to the, you know, the veterans communities a little bit more and, you know, maybe offer something to them, like some sort of like really, you know, like worthwhile discount to, you know, maybe come in and start taking lessons. Because you know, as we all know, music soothes the savage mind. And, you know, there's so much, you know, PTSD out there with veterans. And I think while, you know, it's not a wholesale therapeutic ideal situation, it can be very helpful. And it is definitely something that I would like to move toward in the future. As far as who I am as an artist, As Ricky knows, I do a lot of performing here in northeastern Pennsylvania. I play two full bands, and I do a solo acoustic act that I probably is more a majority of the work that I do performance-wise. And I do like that situation because I can incorporate a lot of my original music into the set. And it's an interesting time that we live in now because, you know, when I first started doing this many, many, many years ago, when I would be performing in bars and restaurants and stuff, people wanted to hear strictly cover music, and that was it. You never deviated from that. But nowadays, people are a lot more open to hearing music that they've never heard before and, you know, hearing original music and stuff. So, you know, that's who I am as a performer. As an artist, I like to put out a new single, ideally once a season. You know, we don't really put out records anymore as musicians. I still do. I put out CDs because, people do still buy them, and there is a huge nostalgic market for that. It's like the kids nowadays collect CDs the way I collect records. So it's interesting. So I do make CDs and I do that, but mostly when I put out new music, I put it out on DistroKid. They're the distribution company, and they put it out on all the streaming platforms on the on the internet. So I think that may sum it up.
Now, Dan, before we get into anything else, I really wanted to ask you, because you were saying about passing it on to the next generation, all kinds of people. Obviously, yeah. One day you had to wake up and say, I want to try this. When did you first discover the power of music and that was something that you wanted to apply into your own life?
Okay, so let me take that in two parts, the power of the music and when I started. I would say I probably came out of the womb with a guitar in my hand. I mean, I don't ever remember a time in my life when I wanted to do something else. Even from just the youngest age, I always envisioned myself playing music. You know, as most young people, I didn't have a clear vision of what I was going to do and where I was going to go. And in this particular career, in this field, if you are lacking in that, you're going to, you're not going to really go anywhere. So that's how I was for many, many years, which leads me to that next question. When I found the power of music, I would probably say that was when probably on, you know, a subconscious level, I really started to notice how music affected people. When I was younger, going to like punk rock shows and hardcore shows, and, you know, music just made people come alive, and just it would just the spirit and the energy of those of those hardcore shows and those punk shows back in those days was you know, it was awesome to witness. And I think that's probably when I started to become aware of it on some kind of level. But I think when I met my good friend and teacher and mentor, Dr. Louise Montello, she was a music therapist in New York City, and she developed this program specifically for performers called Performance Wellness. And it was kind of eye-opening to me the way you can use music to just set a whole tone in a room. And I think that's one of the things that I've noticed, especially over the last couple of years, is that I can go into a room with my guitar and you start playing music and the whole energy of the room changes, whether for good or bad, but it does. And music does have that effect. I'd probably say that would be my answer on that one, Ricky.
Now, you had mentioned you are a music teacher at the Milford School of Music.
Yes.
And you had mentioned the mentorship of Dr. Louise. Is there anything with that Dr. Louise instilled in you that you as a teacher now, for whoever you're teaching, whether it's someone who's 6 years old or 66 years old, is there anything that she instilled in you that you like to instill to your students now?
Well, if they, you know, if they decide to become teachers, definitely. You know, she really didn't, she taught me more like things like, you know, you have to, wherever your student is, that's, you have to start where they're at. And go from there. And it's in teaching, as probably in everything else in life, it's really all about the relationship. And, you know, if you have a, you know, if you can build that relationship, just start from where they are, from where they're at. Don't try to come in with any like preconceived, like, okay, I'm going to teach you how to do this, how to do that. You know, find out where they are, find out what they want to learn, what may have inspired them, like what you know, guitar players they were interested in that made them say, hey, I want to play guitar, you know, that kind of thing.
That was really interesting about meeting people where they are. That's something I always hear about just in life in general. It's a good rule of thumb to have. I wanted
for sure.
to with Lydia and Cody, because you were saying about music, the room changes, and when you play music, and even how you were saying the room changes. I just want to ask Cody and Lydia what they kind of have seen when there's music in a room and what it does to them. Because it really does. I'll tell you, when I'm at work and I hear music, it takes me out of it a second, because you want to hear the lyrics, hear what the person's singing about, if it resonates with you. I just want to ask my co-hosts if they have a similar experience, because I certainly do. Then we can talk about that.
For my side, when you talk about music, wow, music has this effect, you know, you listen to it and you are hooked, and it instantly heals you for some reason. I don't know, it feels like it's a cure to something. The way I love music in general, when I'm in a bad mood or something's just happening, I know I'll listen to music and it will pick me up again. And I also come from a musical background. Like, I have a sister that plays bass, and, you know, so music, it heals. It's something that is so deep and unexplainable, if I could say.
Definitely.
Cody, what about you?
I think for me, music is just, like you said, Lydia, something just so magical that, similar to radio in a way, has the ability to take you to a place where on your own you can't always get into, but in music it is just a vessel for this powerful way of sharing messages.
Well, what's cool about you, Dan, with how you're sharing your messages through your music is because you're saying you put out, I've seen you put out EPs and things of that nature. You record stuff and release it. And you don't come from someone, you see like these big name artists like Bruno Mars and Taylor Swift and people like that who put out EPs and records and really find a, you don't really have that, the finances behind to put out something that huge, sorry to say, but it's just kind of an interesting
Yet.
how do you come together and say, okay, I'm going to put this out, I'm going to record this, I'm going to release it. What's that process like for you as someone who doesn't have Bruno Mars money or something like that?
Excellent, excellent question. So I have probably in the past 4 years, I have this great kind of I guess you would say support with my publishers. I do have a publishing company that I work with, RPM Entertainment. They are fantastic people. I also have a recording engineer that I work with, Ken Fox, who is also an amazing singer and songwriter. Between, and also I do have a very good, I'm very grateful to have a very good pool of studio musicians that, I can call on. That does have a tendency to put me a little bit over budget, so I have been trying to do a lot of stuff on my own recently. But the process is generally, I'll take a lot of time writing songs because I guess, Ricky too, because I don't have that pressure, that Bruno Mars pressure to have to put out the records like that. I do have time, so generally I'll write music and I'll practice it and refine it over, maybe even a year or two before I record it, because I always feel like it's like when you're cooking something, if it's not fully cooked, the results are going to be not good. And the same is true with the song. And I have done that before. I have put out songs that weren't fully cooked. They weren't fully finished. And I came to really regret that later because the tone of the song had changed, or like I had changed just a little something in it. So I always like to make sure that it's done and ready to go. And once I do that, the process is fairly simple. I just bring it into Fox Den Recording Studios where I record, and we generally will just lay down all the rhythm tracks. And if I need to add drums, then I'll send it out to my drummer who has a studio of his own. I shouldn't say my drummer, but the drummer that I hire, and he's does all the tracks on his own in his own studio, and then Ken will mix it, and then usually we'll get about 4 or 5 mixes until we get a final product, and then he'll master it. He sends it to me, and then I upload it to DistroKid. And they put it on all the streaming platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer. The list is pretty long. And of course, during all of this, working with a publisher, I have to have everybody sign contracts because my publisher tries to she works very hard in building relationships with music supervisors, and she's been trying to get me in a lot of syncs, and like any kind of media that we possibly can, like TV shows, commercials, that kind of thing. And you really have to have your all of your I's dotted and T's crossed on that, because if you don't have a contract for every single person you work with, that leaves open the possibility that they could come back and say, hey, I played on this, I'm going to sue you, that whole, like the lawsuits and everything. So it is kind of tedious with the paperwork and everything like that, but it's a process that I've come to refine, probably over the last like 3 years especially. So it just get, it's getting better as we do, each new single. So yeah.
And then you were talking about cooking and making sure that the final product is good, right? Can you
Yes.
like walk with me like through your songwriting process? Like, do you stop with the lyrics, melody, or something? Like, where do you draw inspiration when it comes to songwriting?
Fantastic. You know, I don't have one specific, avenue on that, because it used to be, in all honesty, I always used to do the music first. I would, back, especially when I played in bands, I would always put some sort of music together first. And then if I usually didn't sing back in those days. So then, the vocalists would come in and put lyrics over the music, and we would do it like that. But nowadays, I think probably because about 17 years ago, I really started singing more because I realized that, if you're a singer, you can kind of control your own destiny a lot more. So you can pick your own gigs, and you don't have to worry about, playing with other people and practicing. You can always practice on your own. So once I started singing, I think that changed my songwriting process, because I come up with melodies often, and then I'll have to pick up the guitar to match the chords for the melody. So there's definitely a lot of, there's definitely not one set way that I do that. And very often too, like now, a recent thing that I've been doing is I tune my guitar to an open G tuning, and it opens up all these beautiful, possibilities. So it's one of those things that's just an endless possibility, and is always a mystery to me every time. So the thrill is never going to probably be gone on that.
And, looking back, right, and how you started in the music journey, like, can you take us and tell us how you got to the start of being a performer?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just looking at some old pictures pretty recently of me, probably when I was like 4 or 5 years old. And even at that age, I was so into the band Kiss. I would paint my face and just run around the house, pretending to perform. So, I think I always had that urge. And then once I was in high school and I started playing in bands, and, we would do our first performance at, a high school talent show or something like that. And once you get that rush once, it's like you are always going back to that. And it's just like kind of an addiction, I think, maybe, but a healthy one. I would probably say that performance urge definitely came from that. And it's still as strong as ever. I still, I feel like it has an effect on my well-being if I don't perform regularly. I think it's definitely something that keeps me upbeat for sure.
Amazing stuff. And I'd like to know, personally, how does performing live differ from recording in studio, and which do you prefer and why?
Oh, that's great. So the golden rule there is when you're performing live, you get one shot at it, right? And that's it. But when you're recording, you can do a take like as many times as you want to. And that, that's where I actually did get into trouble on my first record, because I did a lot of the recording on my own, and I kind of got to this weird like perfectionism like thing going on in my head, where I was like, all right, let me do it again and again and again and again. And I would do like a take 60 times, and nobody could tell you what was better, like one take from the other. And I was just, I kind of got a little bit crazy with that perfectionism thing. So when I started recording with Ken about 4 or 5 years ago, he was like, okay, no, we're going to do like at the most 4 takes on something. And as long as I'm well rehearsed going into the studio, that works out well. And I would have to say, choosing between the two, I love both of those processes, and I really don't know which one I would choose. I really don't know.
No, I get you, and I understand. As time changed, things have been moving, right? So how do you balance staying true to your artistic vision while also keeping up with the current musical trends and industry demands?
Well, that is a fantastic question. And I got to the point where I realized, as an artist, I can't really keep up, you know, with really anything like that in general. And so I kind of think that kind of punk rock ethic always comes back to me where, like, if you want to make a scene, if you want to have a scene, then you have to make a scene. So I kind of just feel like I have a lot of work where, you know, I'm out performing cover music. And when I slip my originals in there and people like them, you know, I tell people about them. And I think that's kind of the way I'm doing it. And in honesty, to answer your question, I think that's kind of how I'm doing it. I'm using those venues, you know, that allow me to, you know, do cover music to, you know, slip in my original music. And in that sense, I still feel like I'm keeping, you know, I might not be staying totally true to my artistic vision, but I'm still, you know, I'm still close to it and I'm still, you know, connected to it in some way.
Now, Dan, we've seen a real shift away from labels and an increasing reliance on social media to promote artists. I'm curious, what do you do in your own practice to kind of get your work out there, in addition to, you know, slipping in covers and whatnot?
What, you know, one of the things that I've been doing recently is I turned my, and I'm not just doing this just for, you know, exposure to my music, but it does help. And I have a genuine, obviously a genuine desire to want to help people who are learning the guitar. So I've turned my YouTube channel into a guitar tutorial, a beginner guitar tutorial channel. And that has seemed to bring a lot of traffic to the page. And I'm not saying that everybody's going to, you know, check out the music, but you'll probably have a, you know, percentage of people that are interested and will say, hey, I like the, you know, what this guy's teaching. Let me see, you know, what his music is all about. So I'm trying, you know, that avenue. I think the visualizer, the visualizer videos are pretty cool. The lyric videos. But you know, this is an open question, guys, and I'm totally open to anything that you might have to tell me on promoting music nowadays, because it's every day I learn more and I learn new ways to you know, survive that way in the modern era without record labels. And so, yeah, I'm always open to finding out new avenues in that.
But I really wanted to ask you something about, because I know not only with you promoting your work, not only can you promote it through your solo work, you play in two bands, right? You play in,
yes,
two bands as well. So I wanted to go back to something that Lydia said. Obviously, promoting it with the band is different because you have different input about how you want to market something, sell something, versus doing it solo. What would you say the creative process, how does that differ when you're with a band versus playing solo? How does that differ?
You know, with a band, generally you want, it's mostly a very collaborative effort. Everybody kind of puts their fingerprint on a song, and it's, you're kind of a little bit more limited in your ability to, I don't know, maybe express musically yourself as much as you want to. Yeah, I mean, but the camaraderie, you know, with a band is always different, and I like it. It's kind of like it's a group effort, and you have like a drive to want to make it better, and plus too, it's always good too if you're in a band that you can have different inputs, and you know, people can say, you know, this could be a little bit stronger if we try this, or, you know, this might be a little bit weak, or, you know, something like that. And as long as you keep your ego at the door and take criticism the way, you know, it should be taken, that could be a workable situation. And I, you know, that was always good. But the thing about with bands is that you know, you really have to allow a lot of time for rehearsals, a lot of time for, you know, writing and getting together. And nowadays, I don't have that. So that's why I do revert back to, you know, being a solo artist most of the time.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you about with bands versus playing live.
Yeah.
This is going to be a bit of an odd question, but just roll with it. Which do you think gets more respect from a crowd when you go to, when they see a band come up, when they see a solo artist? What do you think, and audience responses in different ways to both band versus solo artist? I kind of want to get into that a little bit.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And, you know, my answer is this. It depends on the audience. If you are in a restaurant, like say, let's say Mass Hope at 6 o'clock on a Friday, that's the dinner crowd. If you roll up in a band with like big speakers and you're ready to rock that joint, you know, that's not going to go over well. People are not going to be into that. They want nice, quiet dinner music. They want to relax. They want to unwind, hear a little acoustic music or whatever, or maybe some mellow electric, you know, whatever. That's, you know, that's what they want to hear. However, I have been many, many times on the other end of that, where my band had to cancel and I had to cover for them as a solo. And you have a, and this is in a situation where you're more like in a bar, where you have a group of people that are ready to rock. They want to dance. They want to get up and party. And, the, you know, and you're up there with your solo acoustic guitar, and they're not liking that very much. And I absolutely hated having to do that every time. You know, I have had to do that. So, yeah, you know, Ricky, it definitely depends on the crowd with that one.
Now, we've spent so much time talking about how you slip in when you do a live act solo, original work that you've done. We can't have you here without you telling us about some of these singles that you've released and some of the stuff. You have to tell us about some of these songs.
Yeah. No, that sounds great. Well, the last one I put out is a tune called Floatin'. And, you know, kind of going back to that Bruno Mars thing, one of the cool things about being at this level is that I don't really have any pressure to put out like a particular genre or a style of music. So I can be all over the place, because as an artist, I really am all over the place. And I think that comes from being a teacher and, you know, teaching all the different genres and styles that students want to learn, but also performing in, you know, bars and restaurants and trying to, you know, learn and play all the different styles and whatnot that, you know, people in that atmosphere want to learn. Last one that I wrote was, or put out was a tune called, it's a tune called Floatin'. And it reminds me of like a 1920s blues shuffle. I'm particularly fond of an artist. Her name was Memphis Minnie. She was a fantastic finger picking blues player in that era, and it reminds me of that style. I actually had to listen to some of her records to make sure I wasn't plagiarizing anything. So that, you know, that tune is out on Spotify now. The one that I just put out before that is a tune written by a very close friend of mine, Matthew Gerard King. And this tune is called Darker Roads. And his version of it was very mellow, folksy. I rocked it out. I heard that song as like a Ramones kind of like, even slash like alternative new wave kind of thing. I don't know. I heard it differently. So I kind of did a rearrangement of that one. And then the one before that was a tune called I Won't Follow You. And I think that one is the one that I get the most response from when I perform it live. So if there's a hit on the record, that one might be it. But also I have another one that's coming out probably in a couple months. I'm redoing one of my old songs, you know, to go back to that point where I was talking about before. about writing a song and it not being fully done. I did that with a song of mine called Skeletons, and I'm redoing it and putting it out in a couple months. And those are the four songs that are going to be on a little EP that I'm going to probably put into physical form by the summertime, just to have at shows and be able to sell CDs and whatnot at the gigs.
So what's that process like when you were saying, Lydia and you were talking earlier about releasing something and then going back and kind of doing a re-release of it? What's that like in your mind about knowing, okay, what we got right the first time, what we can do better the next time? What's that creative process like? Because it's got to be a little bit different than originally writing a song.
It is. I you know, for me, it just means, you know, I have a tendency to be a little bit hard on myself when it comes to that. So, you know, I have to make sure that it's definitely where I want it to be. And it certainly is now. But yeah, I mean, it's just a matter of going back and, you know, for me on that song, it was just making sure the lyric was right and exactly what I wanted to say. And, you know, and it is. And musically, I had to change things around a little bit because it really wasn't grabbing me the way it was. And, you know, I had to obviously change that.
And you were saying about one of, what was the I Will Follow You, I believe, was the name of the other song you had mentioned?
Yeah, I Won't Follow You, yes.
What do you...
WRCT Pittsburgh. Do not dumb here. Not dumb area here. Chop, 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 chop.
Die! 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 versus Joey. The Johnny Joey, Johnny versus Joey. Who wants to be a favorite Ramon? I don't know, no, 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 no. You got left wing, right wing, have a down, monkey man. I wanna be any one of them. Johnny versus Joey, Johnny versus Joey. Johnny, 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 Joey, 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 Joey. Which one do you want? Which one would you be?
Back when we did Destroyer, we didn't realize how many of those songs would wind up in the Kiss show every year. Some of our favorite songs come off the album Destroyer. Here's one that's really easy to remember. Message is simple. If you want a little rock and roll, all you gotta do, shout it out loud! All the way up there, people! I can see ya! All the way up there, people!
Go ahead and leave a message. You gotta wait till after the beeps.